Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people that I have had the privilege to know, let alone to interview with some regularity, who bring more intelligence to bear on the war for the free world's present phase and who understand better its previous moments and have a clearer eye to what's likely to come next than our guest. I'm very pleased to say for this full hour, he is Mark Helprin, best known as a highly applauded, accomplished, and awarded author, both of fiction and nonfiction, his latest book being Paris in the Present Tense. He is also an essayist of great renown, notably with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, but also in outlets like the Claremont Review of Books and National Review, and we'll be talking with him about some of his recent writings in those publications. He is, and I try not to hold this against him, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy. It is one of my great joys that I call him both a friend as well as a much admired colleague and always a welcome guest here. Mark Helprin, thanks for joining us and for giving us a full hour of your time. We're very grateful. I want to start with the revelations in the past day, which really just have sort of confirmed with hard evidence what has long been, I think, obvious to any reasonably informed observer. And that is that we have been subjected for the past few years, starting in the last year of the Obama administration and going forward to the present moment, really, to an incessant and highly effective, alas, effort to weaponize the intelligence law enforcement agencies of the United States government by Democrats during the Obama years in the executive branch and more recently in the House of Representatives as an instrument of political warfare against their domestic opponents, namely the Republicans and specifically Donald Trump, the candidate, Donald Trump, the president-elect, and subsequently Donald Trump, the president. And I wonder what your thoughts are, Mark. Again, I'm interested in both the specifics of what, you know, is now evident here, but also kind of in this broader context, has this whole caper reduced the United States to something akin to a banana republic in which these things happen all the time?
Well, we're on our way. Let me start off by saying that last night, this was the 7th of May, when the news came that the DOJ is going to drop the Flynn prosecution. I just happened to be watching NBC News because that's our local station. That's really all we get. And the report on that failed to mention that there was an FBI memo in writing that it was not produced originally for Flynn's attorneys, and that was subsequently, just recently, produced. And what it said was, what is our aim in questioning him? Is it to get at the truth, or is it to get him to lie so we can convict him or have him fired? Now, this is the kind of malfeasance which, if you remember the Ted Stevens case, the same prosecutorial malfeasance. And in this case, it was coordinated throughout the FBI and the Department of Justice and the intelligence agencies. I'm thinking specifically of people like Brennan. I have no doubt that the White House was absolutely in on this and that there was a more or less a conspiracy. I detest conspiracy theorists, but all these things come together very nicely. And I want to point out that, given that I saw that report, And there was no mention of the actual physical smoking gun evidence piece of paper that had that, that the left and even the center don't know the specifics of it. And to answer your question very simply, yes, at the end of the Obama administration, because they felt they were so morally superior, and because they felt that the ends justified the means, they absolutely weaponized all the agencies under their command. And we see it in revelation after revelation about Strzok and Page saying, we won't allow this to happen, it's our insurance policy, et cetera, et cetera. They make Nixon look like a piker, really, like a piker. And yet, the country is so polarized that if you say this, you are assumed to be a great Trump fan, you know, and a complete ignoramus who pounds the tub and goes to rallies, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm sort of in the middle. I'm not a Trump fan for many, many reasons. I think that he essentially may have destroyed the Republican Party, although there was part of it that needed definitely amputation. But I'm not in the tank and haven't drunk the Kool-Aid with the Trumps, and yet what you're talking about is absolutely true, and it is a great danger, and it's unfortunate that the media has more or less jumped into the tank with the other side.
Well, I think very much more rather than less. Let me ask you one thing, Mark. As a student of these matters and a bit of a Washington hand, though you've spent much of your life outside of it trying to steer clear of the swamp, I think it's fair to say, the absence of an oversight body and you know, competent performance in that role. Specifically, I'm thinking of the House Intelligence Committee, which some of these documents suggest is talk about in the tank, is part of the problem, not sort of the watchman on the wall, the agency that or entity that is going to try to ensure that this kind of weaponization doesn't take place. How did you find the, I guess, really just the confirmation of what we've been seeing play out now for several months under Adam Schiff's chairmanship of the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, I think, again, as someone who did not vote for Trump, I didn't vote for Hillary either, I think I have some standing to say that I think that Adam Schiff is a new McCarthy. I've never, and also Nadler, he and Schiff have been the leaders in making outrageous accusations and statements, and they're somewhat like Schumer in that I study Schumer. I'm interested in language, of course, and I take a gimlet eye on language. And if you'd analyze Schumer's statements, every other word is a condemnatory adjective, and they're inflammatory as well. And he gives no quarter in his statements to anyone else's motives or actions or anything. It's like agitprop. You know, it's very Soviet.
Mark, I have to ask you to hold that thought because we are out of time for this block. We'll be right back with much more with the author of Paris in the Present Tense and so much more, Mark Halperin. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour, I'm extremely pleased to say, with Mark Halperin, an extraordinary author and essayist, a man of great intellect, especially when it comes to matters involving national security. He thinks about these things intensely, and he writes about them brilliantly, and he's not too bad at talking about them either on air. We're delighted that he's doing it here with us today. Mark Halperin, I wanted to pivot from the critique of some of the incumbent members of the House and Senate to a man that you worked with 15 years ago, who was then the majority leader of the United States Senate, Dr. Bill Frist. Talk a little bit about how you came to help him and a project that at the moment it's a terrible tragedy, was not acted upon as he and you recommended at the time.
Yes. 15 years ago, because my younger daughter was a student at Johns Hopkins in public health, I was reading a lot of books about pandemics and epidemics. And I went to Senator Frist and said, what about this? At that time, of course, we were also concerned about the possibility of non-state actors and even state actors using biological warfare, if you remember the anthrax scare, et cetera. But more threatening were actually emerging pathogens, such as Ebola and H1N1 and SARS, et cetera. And so I realized that we were just not prepared for this at the time. And he, of course, understood. He realized it too, because he's an eminent physician. He truly is one of the world's most eminent physicians. And so he said, absolutely, run with it. And what I did was write him a speech, and he gets the credit because he was in a position to deliver it. He delivered this speech in the Senate at Davos. It was the Harvard Seidman Lecture, which is the most important annual lecture of Harvard Medical School, at Bohemian Grove, and I must say, to his credit, the only one of 500 Bohemians who asked him for a copy of the speech and was enthusiastic about it was Henry Kissinger. And he did everything he could, including, of course, the most important thing, which was to go to the White House, where he did not have to speak to a low-level person, and try to get us prepared for emerging pathogens. And to his credit, President Bush the Second did help and was enthusiastic about it to a point, but Congress only appropriated a couple of billion, maybe $2.5-3 billion for it, and then the Obama administration did not replenish any of the stocks, and in addition threw a tax on medical devices, and of course if you tax anything you get less of it, so it's a very stupid thing to do, but nobody, Republican and Democrat, really did what Frist recommended, which was to establish maybe half a dozen or more centers throughout the country to do research into emerging pathogens with attached manufacturing entities for vaccines and curatives, to stockpile things like PPE and ventilators and field hospitals and arrange for the reserve personnel who could man them. All this based upon recognition of what happened in 1918 with the Spanish flu, when literally the bodies were piled up 10, 12 high outside of the morgues in the major cities of the United States because the morgues had no place to put them. It was something medieval. Well, we didn't do any of that. And what we recommended was $100 billion a year to double the output of medical schools, nursing schools, laboratory technicians. We wanted to make tax advantages for pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies if they would adhere to certain conditions, which they would have been happy to adhere to, such as working on orphan drugs and researching into these emerging pathogens. Orphan drugs are drugs that are for diseases that affect not that many people, so the pharmaceutical companies don't invest the capital to investigate them. And so had we done this, $100 billion a year for about the first 5 years, which would have accomplished this, and maybe anywhere from $25 to $50 billion thereafter per year to maintain it, and at a very high level, and that would have totaled, until now, maybe $1 trillion at most. And in the past 3 months, we have spent money that we don't have, essentially printed it and made all kinds of guarantees that are going to snap back and bite us later, $6 trillion just in the past 3 months. This will probably end up costing the United States $10, $15, $20 trillion and the world $30, $40 trillion in lost production and economic disaster, et cetera. So a stitch in time is very important. And I almost can guarantee you that after this, whenever that may be, we won't take the proper steps, just as we don't take the proper steps and are not taking the proper steps in defense preparedness.
Well, this is a subject that I want to dwell on with you, Mark, because one of the things that I have valued so much about your public warnings and our private conversations over the years is your appreciation of the importance of preparedness, both in terms of deterring bad things from happening, in some cases, if you're lucky, and at the very minimum, having the ability to contend with them when they do. And I want to start a conversation with you about, you know, the various reasons that preparedness, particularly the defense preparedness, is so vital in just a moment. But before we leave this topic of basically biological warfare, as you know, there is a very active debate underway at the moment as to whether what we have been subjected to really amounts to a biological attack against our country. President Trump, I think yesterday, described this rightly as far worse than Pearl Harbor or 9/11, and that we have indeed been attacked. He didn't say that the Chinese were deliberately responsible for that, though Senator Tom Cotton, a man I think we both admire, has done so. But he did say that it could have been stopped at its source, namely in China. And I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the character of this particular pandemic, as well as, of course, its source, and what the Chinese have taken away from this experience, and probably other enemies of this country have as well.
Okay, well, to begin with, as perhaps everyone knows or should know, all major powers since the First World War have been invested in chemical and biological warfare, and that includes the United States. We have had and still have labs which investigate, as they should, because of the possibility of responding to them, all kinds of pathogens and chemical warfare agents, etc. In Russia, they had a tremendous establishment for this. There was an escape, I believe, in Sverdlovsk of anthrax, which was blown in a wind plume and killed many, many, many people. I do believe that this virus may have escaped from a Chinese lab, and they would be embarrassed about that, so they'd cover it up. But I think there is not a shred of evidence that it was done on purpose. I do not believe it was done on purpose. China was already in a period of instability, and when you unleash something like this, you can't control it. So I don't lean toward that.
There is this question, though, as to whether they conducted themselves in a way that assured its spread elsewhere, which is, of course, the part of this that is particularly of concern to us, not only in this country, but many others besides. Your thoughts on that?
I don't think they did that on purpose. It would be very hard to prove.
Well, the proof, Mark, though, just if I may interrupt you, the proof is in the time lag between when they knew of the nature of the problem and when they told the rest of the world about it, and the fact that they permitted people from their country, including the city of Wuhan, to leave the country in large numbers, which all, I think, raises the question as to whether there was some malice aforethought to this. Not necessarily that it was a biological weapons attack in the traditional sense that you and Bill Frist were worrying about, but that the practical effect of how they conducted themselves amounted to such a thing on us and others.
I think it was more bureaucratic malfeasance or, you know, lack of coordination, ham-handedness, in the same way that we didn't take certain steps that we could have when we first knew about it. I don't think it's that. And in addition, I also think it's kind of irrelevant because China is a given, just the way Russia is a given, and nuclear weapons pointed at us are a given, and Islamic terrorists are a given. What's important is how we respond, not whom we blame. Let's just assume that you assume the worst case, that someone will unleash biological weapons against us. It's our responsibility to be prepared for this, and there's nothing much we can do if in fact that's the case by saying, oh, well, you know, China's bad. Well, yeah, we know that China's bad, but in terms of China is competing with us to dominate the world, and we have to take the proper steps, and it's kind of useless to wonder about, you know, motives or whether or not they did this. We should be prepared for such a thing, period.
Well, I take that point, but I also think if you're in the business, as we both are to varying degrees, of trying to encourage the American people and their elected representatives to take actions to assure we are prepared, again, hopefully, to deter and, if necessary, to contend with these kinds of eventualities, that we actually understand that what has befallen us emanated from a country that is determined to destroy us and displace us as the dominant power of the world, and quite possibly has taken away from this whole experience, whether it was simply a matter of, you know, adapting to circumstances or had some malevolent purpose to it, that they have terrified the American people, that they have devastated our economy, and that they have sidelined, at least for the moment, much of our military, particularly in the Western Pacific, all of which is a strategic takeaway that I'm fearful is not going to be lost on some other bad guys too. Mark, we have to pause. When we come back, we're going to start talking about the bad guys in earnest and what we need to be doing about them. Straight ahead with Mark Halperin.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are talking for this full hour with Mark Halperin. He is mightily contributing to the public policy debate through, among other things, some very thoughtful pieces recently at the Claremont Review of Books and National Review. And I'm anxious to sort of draw you out, Mark, on the larger question of what China is up to. We've talked about this biological problem and our vulnerability to it. Give us a sense, as you see it, of the 30,000-foot view of China's ambitions, as well as the capabilities that they're putting into place to realize them.
Okay, I'd be happy to. Let me start by saying that I went rowing, because where I live you can still exercise, and I went to the boathouse, and there was another car there, and it had a bumper sticker, and the bumper sticker said, had a picture of the Earth from space, and it said, "It's a planet, not an empire." And I thought, well, what does this person really mean? And I went through in my mind asking him, and the answer that they probably would have given was, well, it's a planet. We have to save the planet, and it's having the American Empire is a terrible thing, and we should turn our attention to so. In other words, against the Pax Americana. And what I would have said to that person was, look, would you like to live under the Chinese totalitarian system, or under the Islamicist system, or under the Russian Putinesque system? Would you prefer to live under those systems than the Western system, the Western democratic system? And they, of course, would have had to say no. And then I would have said, well, how do you think you're going to stop those systems, which now are competing for world dominance, from actually dominating the world and then eventually dominating us and you, right down to your neighborhood? And so that now you may say, well, I can go to Starbucks and get a cup of coffee. What's the problem? Well, the history doesn't work that way. Eventually, things have consequences. And we are in a struggle, just as we were during the Cold War, just as we were in World War II. There is struggle forever. The struggle now is global, and it has to do with these three major systems which are competing for dominance of the world. Now, the Islamic system, Islamicist system, is the weakest of them, and yet it has great strengths in many areas. The Russian system is similarly weak in that right now it has been pushed back into a relatively small area. But the Chinese system is very, very, very threatening and strong. And it coordinates perfectly with the Chinese, with the ancient Chinese, even prehistoric worldview. Of course, we can't know the prehistoric worldview, but it seems to have stemmed from very, very ancient tendencies, that China is the Middle Kingdom, and that essentially everything else is barbaric and should give tribute to China, and China should control the known world. And what China is doing now, well, with its various initiatives, and I would say that the number one is building up its military to the point where it will soon be equal to our own, and two, the Belt and Road Initiative, in which it is extending its tentacles very far into Western Europe. People have no idea how much it controls ports and trade and other relations with the West, including tremendous initiatives to dominate Africa and South America. This is a giant, giant system with immense wealth, immense talent, and it has the their point of view is that, well, we will be the new world hegemon. And this is undeniable. Look, for example, at the South China Sea. I was in a group in which included, this was 10, 15 years ago, Bob Work, who was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And in this group, we were talking then about the South China Sea. And I said, well, it's gone. We've lost it. Because at that point, they already started building those islands, et cetera. And he said, no. And I said, no. And then I presented a case, you know, essentially the naval case of why we have lost the South China Sea. There's no way that China will not control that area. And that's tremendously important. That would be as if the United States claimed the entire Caribbean as its territory. And, I mean, this is an expansionist empire, and it's at the beginning of its run. And we are not taking the proper steps to secure our allies in the Western Pacific, and actually even to secure the Western Hemisphere as a possible last bastion, because Europe is so weak, it will be dominated eventually either by Russia or the Islamicists. And Asia, if we keep on going the way we're going, it will be dominated by China, as will Africa, and what's left essentially would be the Western Hemisphere. We should pay attention to essentially a new Monroe Doctrine, because if we do not secure the Western Hemisphere, and there are many ways in which we could do that, especially since we have the oceans on either side, we have a Latin population with which we can make overtures to South America, and we have the wealth to do it. And we have the Ken to do it too. If we don't do that, then at least a fallback position, we're going to be in great trouble. And I just want to say that by the way, the Trump administration has cut the military budget for fiscal year 2021. And let me say this: why not, with those $6 trillion that we spent in the past 3 months, and much more is coming, why not take maybe $1 trillion and put it to increasing the defense, our defense? The defense industries, look, there are 3.5 million employees just in aerospace. You know, if you build an aircraft carrier, there are 2,000 subcontractors that work on an aircraft carrier in addition to the big one. If we were to invest some of this stimulus money into defense, we could solve two problems at once. We would help to reinvigorate the economy, and we would attend to our declining preparations.
Mark, this is a really important point, and I don't want to cut it short, but I do want to cover a couple of other things. Before we move from China, though, I did want to just say I strongly agree with what you've said here, with one possible caveat, and I wanted to draw you out on it. As you know, as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which I'm very grateful, one of the things that we have been focusing a lot of effort on is exposing the degree to which China's wealth may not be quite as vast as it seems, because to a considerable degree, they are relying on infusions of capital from our stock and bond markets, and have done for quite some time, some say to the tune of $3 trillion to date, and that they've got aspirations to secure another $3 to $5 trillion from them in the period ahead, including from the men and women in uniform of the United States military and their civilian counterparts in the federal government, whose pension funds are now poised to be made available to some of these Chinese companies, including ones building the very weapons you're talking about to threaten us. Your thoughts on that?
For sure, there's that, and there's also the fact that their technological wealth the root of it has been that they've stolen it from us through espionage, which began in probably the 80s, ever since the Deng Xiaoping, but certainly in the 90s and in the years since, they have stolen and gotten a head start from our technology. Then there's the other thing, which is that of course they buy our bonds, and they have that as like a wire, a noose around our neck, because depending on what they do with the bonds, of course it would affect them too. They have a means to control us. And if you go all the way back to the Clinton years, we know that they have bought off certain politicians. And let me say something about this, and that is this. I once, sometime in the 90s, after the fall of the Soviet Union, had dinner with Bob Gates when he was the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, for those who don't know. And it turns out that when we got the Russians' archives from their intelligence agencies, we bought them and we have them. We found that there were 600 American journalists from the top to minors who were on the payroll of the Russian Disinformation Department. And the Bob Gates took this to President Bush the first, and he said, "Shall we? You know, what are we going to do with this? Are we going to expose it?" President Bush, I think, wisely said, "We can't do that, because we can't really vouch for the genuineness of this, and also it's, you know, Russia has dissolved, and I mean the Soviet Union has dissolved, and you know, we just let it be." But the lesson from that is not whether or not we should have exposed them, but that there were 600 major journalists in the pay of the Russian disinformation, the Soviet disinformation department. And I know other things vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia and China in terms of buying, just I'll say it directly, politicians. So there's that too. I mean, the Chinese have corrupted, China has corrupted the American political system to some extent, and that bears further looking into. If you look at the Cox Report, which is a multi-volume report, Cox Commission report in the 90s, no one's going to go read that, but if you do read that, you'll see how it's verified that, in fact, China has corrupted the American political system.
They have indeed, and we're reaping the whirlwind for it every day. Mark, we're going to pause for another final break, and when we come back, I want to come back to some of your thoughts on Russia, but I appreciate very much your comments on China. It's a very, very important wake-up call, if we need one, even still after this pandemic. But we'll be right back with more with Mark Halperin right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the final and fourth installment of this conversation with Mark Halperin, a serious student of what I call the war for the free world in its myriad phases, and one of those who has really helped through his writings, both in his various fiction and nonfiction works, as well as his periodical literature, to our understanding of the kinds of challenges we're facing and what we need to do about them in this phase of the war for the free world. Mark, I know you wanted to just make a final point about China, and then we're going to pivot to Russia. Go ahead.
Yeah, the final point is that the presumed Democratic nominee for president, Joe Biden, went to China when he was vice president, and his ne'er-do-well son, who knew nothing about anything, really, came back with a multi-billion dollar deal from China. This just is one of the illustrations of how China corrupts other political systems. And we have it right in front of us right now.
And Michael Pillsbury, who's something of a scholar on these folks, say that they are laughing at us because they have so severely corrupted us that even in the face of the things that they do that are provocative and obviously menacing, are receiving so scant response from us. But let me turn to Russia, Mark, because there's a lot to talk about there. You've sort of set this up by describing the Russian ambitions for world domination as, you know, somewhat weaker just given their current status, but still very much present. And I think a lot of people would find that surprising, that there is anything to be feared from the Russians. I personally believe part of the reason that we have much to fear from the Russians is that, whether it's with respect to journalists in this country who are in their pay, or whether it's more to the point, sort of the communist apparatchiks who simply did a Chapter 11 reorg on the old Soviet Union, led by Vladimir Putin, of course, we're confronting still many of the same tendencies and ambitions in the absence of, as I say, sort of lustration, as I guess it's called. Talk about Russia, what it's up to. And one of the things that I'd like you specifically to address, if you can, in connection with your stated concerns about what's going on in our hemisphere, there are reports that we are probably in the throes of a new missile crisis with Russia, that it is placing certainly warships with nuclear weapons aboard them in Cuban ports. And there's even some talk that they're placing on the seabed off the coast of Cuba nuclear missiles of some kind, cruise missiles or otherwise. So comment about sort of what Russia is up to, not just over there, not just vis-a-vis the Europeans, but in our so-called, well, I think of it as our front yard as well.
Well, actually, I'm not qualified to comment about those things that you just mentioned. I find it very interesting, but I haven't heard about that. However, in general, what I can say is there are two things that one has to be concerned about in Russia. One is nuclear, and the second is the weakening of Europe. Russia has always had, the Soviet Union had, and now Russia has, a very promiscuous and flexible nuclear doctrine. That for instance, they have this really odd idea that they can escalate to de-escalate. In other words, they think that the way to de-escalate the route to nuclear weapons is to use a nuclear weapon and scare everybody, and then suddenly everyone would calm down. And that's terribly dangerous. And the one area where they put their resources almost without limit is in nuclear modernization and nuclear weapons. And one of them, whether or not it's a seabed or not, is that they claim to have a nuclear-powered cruise missile, which could go, for instance, you know, down across the Indian Ocean and up from Antarctica over South America and hit us where we're not looking, you know, from a direction where we're not looking. But in any case, they have a wide variety of nuclear modernization, whereas we have completely neglected our nuclear forces until they're virtually obsolete, almost obsolete now. And so that's one thing. And the second thing is the weakening of Europe. Europe is devolving, not only within countries, but also within its overall structure, which never could have worked politically, the EU. Economically, sure, but politically doesn't work because there's still nations, which is the nations are the most efficient and logical form of social organization, and the EU attempted to get rid of that and make itself a model after the United States. Well, the United States could do it because we didn't start out as separate nations. And the EU can't do it, and Europe is disintegrating, and it's weakening culturally, morally, etc. So it will be, I've always thought for many, many years now, that it will be taken over either by Islam or by Russia. And it has virtually no defense left on its own, and NATO is de facto disappearing. So if there were Russia could control whether directly or through influence and sway of power, the European continent, and if China controls the Asian and Central Asian continent, then Africa and South America are up for grabs, and we may find ourselves literally isolated in the world. And things are not the way they were in the 19th century. The seas don't protect us to the extent that they used to.
Indeed, as we've seen with airplanes filled with people who are sick, as well as ballistic missiles. Mark, let me turn quickly. Much more to say about Russia, of course, and I would welcome a return visit with you where we can drill down on this even further. But I so very much agree with your point, particularly about the dangers of the Russian nuclear modernization program. This is a subject, interestingly enough, of a new book by the Center for Security Policy Press that I commend to all of you. It is available for free as a PDF downloadable file. It's about our parlous nuclear posture and what we need to do about it. I commend our colleague and president, Fred Flights, for his leadership in pulling that book together, and it's required reading, really. But Mark, let's turn quickly to the two other bad actors that I know you have been spending a lot of time thinking about as well. China's cat's paw proxy, puppet, call it what you will, North Korea, with the presumed continued leadership of Kim Jong-un, and the Twelvers, who are in charge of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who have long believed that on their watch they will bring back the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, the Messiah figure, and presumably trigger the apocalyptic events that are required to do that.
Okay. The problem with North Korea is that even before North Korea got enough nuclear weapons to really be a problem, destroy South Korea, destroy Japan possibly, and now reaching toward us with their longer range missiles, and it'll be a while, but sub-based missiles. The problem with North Korea, even before that, was that they had a tremendous suite of biological and chemical weapons with which they could have annihilated the South. So they made themselves sort of untouchable, either full-scale, huge war, or you can't do much to stop them from doing whatever they're doing. And we're still in that situation. There isn't an easy way out. With Iran, there is an easy way out, comparatively, in that they do not have, at this point, an arsenal of nuclear weapons. They're close, and they will have, if we continue as we have continued, first of all, with the Obama administration essentially helping them, not essentially, actually helping them, giving them, releasing billions of dollars to them, and allowing, giving them a pathway to a nuclear weapon, it formalized in an understanding, which thankfully President Trump has canceled, but the Europeans still adhere to, and Russia and China support. So that's a big problem, and we could take care of it now. I was disappointed that the second President Bush didn't essentially destroy their nuclear capacity as a parting gift when he left. It would have been a great thing to do, and I do not understand why he didn't do that. But they are vulnerable in terms of, we could set them back 30 and 40 years. People say, well, if you bomb them, they'll just make new nuclear. Well, no, they won't, because it's taken them 30 or 35 years to get to this position. If we destroy their apparatus, it would take them another 35 years, and they probably wouldn't even attempt to do it because they would know that we would simply do it once again.
Unfortunately, that has to be the last word on this subject for this moment. I am salivating at the opportunity to visit with you further about it, and particularly to talk about the sorts of things that we need to do in addition to enhancing our preparedness and reestablishing a viable defense industrial base. But it will be for another day. And Mark Halperin, I thank you so much for your thoughts today and for all that you do to inform the rest of us, challenge our thinking, and otherwise raise awareness about the fact that America is in a dangerous period in this war for the free world, and we must resolve to prevail in it. Thank you for your time today, Mark, and the chance to visit with you, I hope, in the near future is one I look forward to with great expectation. I thank you for the time to visit with the rest of you, and hope you'll come back to us again on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.